Spalding Gray is a master of the monologue. His life is his art and his show, or is that the other way around? In his one-man shows, Swimming to Cambodia, Monster in a Box, and Gray's Anatomy, Spalding Gray sits behind a desk on an otherwise bare stage, but he decorates the stage with vivid depictions of his fantasies, phobias, Freudian flashbacks, and reworked anecdotes. His newest one-man show and book is called Morning, Noon, and Night, and in this one he describes his latest role in life as a father and a stepfather. Spalding Gray joins us from the studios of member station WPBX in Long Island, New York. Mr. Gray, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Glad to be here.
And becoming a father, I think we can say you're in your 50s, right?
I'm 58, yep.
Did becoming a father relatively late in life increase your sense of moment and poignance about being a father?
Oh, it just increased everything. I mean, I wasn't ever expecting it to happen. It wasn't really something that I was focusing on in my life and expecting to come about. And when it did, it was at first a huge crisis. And then upon meeting my son, I got very quickly anchored and had this incredible experience of, I suppose, what's loosely called unconditional love, in which I was all of a sudden naturally relating to someone outside of myself without effort, and I wondered when the effort was going to come. You know, at first it was like too good to be true. It was like a honeymoon. And so that was just such a surprise that I'm still, I guess, dealing with that.
Without getting technical about it, when you had your first son, well, it doesn't sound like it was the product of a lot of planning. It happened in a very improvident manner.
I referred to birth of both my children as glorious accidents. And someone said to me recently, actually, my sister-in-law said, do you know how many children are in therapy? Because their parents said they were accidents. And I said, for me, it's not a pejorative term. And I am certainly letting my sons know that through how I interact with them and also the history that I'm leaving of their being in the writings and the monologues.
Let's not be mysterious. Your first son was born when you were to a woman when you were married to someone else.
Right. Yeah. So that was a big crisis. I didn't see my first son until he was 8 months old.
Mr. Gray, could I get you to bring to life for us a part of your monologue and book where you just talk so simply and beautifully about awakening in the morning in proximity to your infant son. He was an infant then, Theo. And you talk about the fact that he was both your son with an O and a son with the U.
Theo, my double son, my S-O-N, my S-U-N, and props himself up to look out the north window at the village of Sag Harbor and lets out with a little toothless, he looks like the little old Italian winemaker that used to be on the bottle of Italian Swiss colony wine. And he lets out with a little cackle and then a little delightful, ooh. And Kathy wakes beside him saying, where's the light, Theo? Where's the light? And so that's the whole beginning of the day, and it begins with him really looking out over the village and me somewhat seeing the town through his eyes.
Yeah. It's interesting. You write about the fact that the entry of children into your life not only made a place for the kind of pure joy that you describe there in waking up with Theo, but also pure anger.
Right. I talk about how it liberated my passive-aggressive personality to have direct rage. And I think that's what having children has taught me, and that is the fluidity of the emotions and just let it go, let it go. You know, the adult has to say let it go. The child is already letting it go. And I just find that really healthy.
Mm. Help construct for our audience your family unit that you take up in this monologue, in this
right.
book. There's Marissa, who is your stepdaughter.
Marissa, who is 13, but in the monologue, she's 11, because that's 1997. And she's very quick, very witty, very complicated, because she comes from a broken home. Kathy and Marissa's dad broke up when Marissa was only two. Mm-hmm. And I think that often leads to a more complicated child. And then my son, Forrest, who in the monologue is five, will be seven next week. And he is definitely the word man. He's very reflective, very much into. In fact, he gave me a note the other day for my monologue that made it better. I'm always taking last-minute notes.
Okay, so Forrest, Marissa,
and
Forrest,
then Theo,
and Theo. Yeah.
Theo is a complete falling down stairs, hitting head, skiing already at two, swimming now in the ocean with a little float suit on, and just he's ready to skydive next year.
Let me ask a bit about Marissa, your stepdaughter.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me it's almost more difficult to be a good stepfather than it is to be a good parent, because a stepfather doesn't have any rights in the matter. You must be very reluctant to exert authority, for example.
No, Marissa can really fire my direct rage up, you know, and it's very convincing. We have really good breakthroughs. I hang in there for a while, and I get to the point where I start complaining to Kathy that Marissa feels like a boarder here. You know that I'm not, we're not interrelating with her because she is now moving into being a teenager, but. Mm-hmm. Then there was something, an incident that was very, frustrating about a new school that Marissa's going to, and Kathy had just reached her end to talking, and she said, "You've got to go upstairs and talk with her." Mm-hmm. And I just felt that I feared rejection, you know, and to go up to her room and approach. And I went up, and it was just 2 nights ago, and sat on her bed. She was sitting behind her desk, and we talked for a good half hour, and she was very open, and it worked. And then it was just, there was no, like, closure to it. And then just before coming over to talk with you here, I told her I was going over to Southampton, and she'd be alone for a little bit before the babysitter came. And she came down and gave me a big kiss on the cheek and hugged me.
Aww.
And so, it comes and goes, and it really is a matter of hanging in and being present.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some sections where you write about her father, to whom the woman with whom you now share your life was...
Also sharing her life.
Also sharing her life. Nobody is married in this narrative, I notice.
No one is married, and the critics all make us married when they review these. It's funny.
Well, may I ask, was it artistically and even morally necessary to include the unflattering characterization of Marissa's father? Because even if he deserved it, she must love him, and she's still got to grow up.
It probably is to do with the fact that there's such a war going on that I took sides, you know, and I feel some, I won't say remorse, but some doubts about it. And she is so prepared to defend him that it hasn't become an issue yet. You know, she's seen the monologue. She has not seen it as something that, at least she hasn't expressed it to me yet. But it may be there, and it may come up.
You suggest in the book that a wise father can not only help to make his children brave, but also perhaps wisely fearful.
I think I talk some more in the book than I do in the monologue about having grown up in with a Christian Science mother and a very passive, non-religious father. Mm-hmm. And we were told there was nothing to be afraid of in God's perfect world. So therefore, everything was and everything wasn't. Mm-hmm. And there was no contrast. And I've really tried to have been with the children, with Forrest in particular, fairly clear on what I think... some real fears, you know, could be that there is darkness and evil in the world, and there are things to be afraid of besides the rides in Disney World.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Gray, does becoming a parent increase your own appreciation for your parents?
Oh, enormously. I mean, I dedicated the book to them, and it's kind of sad that I came into it so late because neither of my parents are alive, but I think and visualize them in ways I never had before. The memories are seeing them as the people being tested, mm-hmm. and how they hung in there and how they stayed together in spite of a lot of ups and downs. You know, and to this day, I can never really get angry at my mother for killing herself, although people tell me that's the healthiest thing to do. I mean, I saw her as being very, you know, psychotic, that it was something that had to be done.
Mm-hmm. You have one particularly hilarious scene where you the whole family, the Spalding Gray family, sits down to a delicious, certainly sounds like a delicious lamb stew that your companion in life, Kathy, has made. But the kids want their snack food.
Right. And it starts with actually Marissa's father, who often would call at dinner time, and she'd take the phone upstairs. And then Kathy says, "No, you get Marissa down here to help you set the table." So I go to the stairs and yell, "Marissa, get down here and help me set the table." And she says, "How much are you going to pay me?" And I yell, you know, you're not working in a hotel. This is a family project here. So she comes down and starts setting the table with attitude like a slave princess. Kathy brings Theo in and puts him in the high chair. He's bucking and kicking. She goes, oop, I smell a poopy diaper. Forrest goes, don't say that word poopy, Mom, when I'm about to eat. I say, Forrest, there's an example of a word in context. You see, poopy has become a bad word for you. For me, a poopy diaper isn't bad. It smells like an exotic overripe French cheese. Marissa goes, Spaulding, how can you talk like that at the table? And I say, wait a minute, Marissa, are you censoring me at my dinner table? She says, your dinner table? I thought this was a family project. And so it goes. And it just builds and builds and builds. And it's an attempt to, you know, show that chaotic table that we've had many of.
When you spend 2 years developing a monologue and a year touring with it, does it put your maturation on hold?
It does something else that's kind of skitsy that I have to look out for. Yeah. It makes me begin to be more comfortable with the story about the family than living with the family, because it does that thing of, you know, what all good art does is that it orders chaos. And you get a grip on it, you feel in control, and you make it and you make the story, no matter how chaotic it is, as well done as possible. Therefore, it becomes transcendent. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly I'm out on the stage with the perfect family, in the sense that it's the perfect monologue, all finished and done. And then I start to – the risk is that I want to live in that reality and not come home to the real world, you see.
Right.
And I think that's something that really – I really have to watch.
Mr. Gray, it's been very nice talking to you.
Oh, good talking with you, Scott.
Spaulding Gray, who's the author, his most recent monologue is Morning, Noon, and Night. He's going to be touring the country shortly performing that monologue. It is also a book published under the same name.